This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's some good news and some bad news about the enormously lucrative market for video games. The good news is the industry truly is massive. It raked in $27 billion just last year. The bad news is it's not growing. By and large, the people who grew up with video games are the ones who play them now. And yes, they are mostly guys. To attract those hardcore gamers, companies try to deliver the digital bells and whistles they demand, and better graphics drive the cost of development sky high. So even if you come up with that next hot shoot-'em-up game, for example, you're still going to be competing for that same stagnant market. In order to grow, almost everyone agrees that the industry needs to find ways to attract older people and especially females, and that may require different games, different designs, different ways of thinking. Nintendo has one idea. On Sunday, they released their new video game console, the Wii, which is aimed at non-traditional gamers. Instead of an intimidating array of buttons and a joystick, the Wii controller allows you to punch, swing, steer, or shoot with the controller. We'll talk with the vice president of Nintendo of America in just a couple of minutes. Later in the program, The Few, the story of seven American flyers who risked everything to fight with the Royal Air Force during the Battle of Britain. But first, if you're a gamer, do you want more sophisticated technology or more compelling storylines? If you're not a gamer, what keeps you away? Why don't you try it? And if you work in the industry, where do you see the business heading? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. To begin, we're joined by Lev Grossman, who writes about technology for Time magazine. He was with us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
And I guess we shouldn't be too alarmist. I don't think the video game industry is going off the deep end tomorrow.
Well, you know, I wonder about that sometimes. The video game industry grew enormously in the 1990s from a cottage industry, basically, to an industry approximately the size of Hollywood, of the movie industry. The last few years, it has not really grown. What has grown is the price of developing games. Now games have budgets in the $10 to $20 million range. If the price of producing your product keeps growing and the market doesn't grow, there's a problem.
There's a problem, but again, it's not as if that $27 billion goes away all at once.
Well, no, but you get to keep less of it because you're spending more on your product. What's happened, I think, is there's a bit of a creative crisis in the industry. Games are largely about two things, about shooting people and about playing sports. And all the people who want to shoot people and play sports are basically already buying games. Mm-hmm. And what the industry needs to do is figure out some way to attract new people because their costs are getting higher.
Well, one of the problems they have in that respect is that there's a sort of stigma associated with video games among non-gamers. It's hard to overcome.
Games are very strange in that respect. Unlike in other media, if you don't play games, there's a good chance that you kind of hate them. I don't like the ballet especially, but I don't think people who watch the ballet are violent and poorly socialized. But people who aren't gamers tend to mistrust games and people who play them.
Mm-hmm. So there are exceptions, though. These multiplayer online games, those seem to be growing, and they seem to be attracting a significantly higher percentage of women.
This I find fascinating, and it's one of the areas in the gaming industry that kind of gives me hope for games as a medium. The line between games and social activities and just regular communities is being blurred by games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft, where you spend part of your time hitting monsters with swords, but you also spend part of your time socializing and hanging out with other people. And that's fun, and it's fun in a way that is relatively new.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. And we'll begin with Justin. Justin calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to express my opinion that I see video games as an emerging art form, one that's been developing a lot over the past two decades, really. And that I see video games as having the potential to sort of transcend the basics of the games right now that are just the sort of shoot-em-ups and the sports games into works that are truly an artistic experience to play. Beyond the simple the visuals or the music, the act of playing the game is something that can provide an emotional experience that is completely unlike any other medium that I've been exposed to.
Lev Grossman, what do you say?
I hope that that is true. I'm myself a pretty avid hardcore gamer, but I'm conscious of the fact that if games were movies, it would be as if there were only really one kind of movies, and that's action movies. Games need to figure out how to broaden their emotional palette, their emotional range. Right now, they deliver kind of a adrenal excitement. But, you know, it's rare, it's not unheard of, but it's rare for me to feel moved by a video game.
I would like to comment that the genre of the video game plays a huge role in that. I mean, if you take a shooter like a game like Halo, for example, that provides a very different experience than a role-playing game like a Final Fantasy or a Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks very much for the call, Justin. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Nintendo took a big gamble this year with the release of the Wii, a video game console designed to attract the non-gamer market. Perrin Kaplan is vice president of Nintendo America. She joins us from the studios of our member station KUOW in Seattle. It's nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, from the rainy West Coast.
That's raining at back east, too. Don't worry about it. So let me ask you, did technology come up and people said, whoa, we could do something with this and it would be completely different? Or did Nintendo come up with something and say, we need to do something completely different. Let's find the technology to do it.
You know, technologically nowadays, you can do almost anything. For us, it really came out of what Lev described, and that is that the genre of games became too narrow. And we noticed that people who used to play games have moved on to other things, having kids, you know, being busy with work.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to figure out something that would make it simply fun for them. They don't have to invest in, you know, something that is five novels deep, something they can just pick up, play really easily, and enjoy and put back down and go on with the rest of their lives.
I have to say, you've made a strong point. I didn't grow up with video games, and then to try to pick up a Madden football game at this point, I don't have time enough to do all that studying. I don't know, much less make my fingers work that well.
Well, I think two things have occurred. One is, you know, we continue to be very committed to the gamer, the hardcore gamer, by providing new experiences. So there has to be something for them as well so that they'll stick with it. As Lev said, it's a really large industry. But for everybody else, you take a look at a controller like that, too many buttons, can't figure out what to memorize, what to do. The games are really, you know, deep and complex. And you say, you know what, I can't do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in investing 18 hours. And kind of that's not really my thing. So we developed a controller that really looks like a TV remote. It's got only a few buttons. It's based on full motion in terms of, let's say you're playing tennis. You swing your arm back like you would with a racket, and you swing it forward. And it's very precise, and you can hear the sound, and you can feel it. And, you know, really for once, right now as I'm interviewing, you're talking to someone who has become a player again.
You, yourself.
Myself.
Yourself. Lev Grossman, I know that you've played with the Wii as well, and you liked it, especially for tennis.
I did. Nintendo with the Wii, they're doing kind of what I'm talking about. They're certainly taking a huge risk by innovating in the way that they have. But the Wii controller does two things. One, it puts you physically in the game. It's very immersive in a way that other controllers haven't been. You're waving your arms, you're jumping around, you're kind of acting out the game as you play it. It's almost impossible not to have a good time while you're doing that. And I want to add a second point, which is that you look like you're having a good time. When people play with conventional controllers, their eyes glaze, their thumbs twiddle, their mouth kind of goes a little bit slack. But when someone's playing with a Wii, they look like they're having a good time. And somebody walking by, a family member, a coworker, wants to get in on that and say, hey, let's have a good time together, which is, it's really quite new.
Perrin Kaplan, I wonder, as you're looking at a new way to play games, as well as, doesn't that imply you need new kinds of games as well?
You really do. We do have a lot of really deep games like Zelda, which launched with this system. That's the first time we've done that. And that's for people who want that really deep, immersive, emotional experience. But we have simplified some of the games. They're deep once you get into them. But for example, let's take the tennis game again. You can do what's called a me character. You can build a character. Let's say I'm going to build Lev, and I happen to know what he looks like, and I can build him, and then I can put him into the game.
With a very weak backhand, I hope.
Well, it would be if I plan on winning. And then I'd put myself in the game, and we can play against each other. Then if I choose to go over to his house, I can take my me, M-I-I, which is of me, to his house and put myself into his system and begin to populate it and show up in games there.
Huh.
And it really, the bottom line is it's just a hoot. It's just plain fun, and that's what we're about. And we now have really proven results with our DS portable system and BrainAge and some other software. And now with the Wii launch as of last weekend, sales are incredibly brisk, and we're finding that we're getting, you know, all the old customers and then a bunch of new ones. We've got evidence in the last couple of days of 60-year-old grandparents teaching their teenage grandkids how to play. we've been working with AARP this last year and a half, and I have to say it's been an absolute pleasure for us.
Let's see if we could get a caller in on the line. This is Chris. Chris joining us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller here, kind of nervous. But the Nintendo Wii, yeah, it's awesome. I just got one on Sunday, and I guess the point that I wanted to bring up is you guys were talking about the massive video game budgets and how it's disproportionately growing according to, like, the number of video gamers out there. And the Nintendo Wii, which I don't think you've made this point yet, uses the same APIs, the software code, to communicate with the hardware as the GameCube. And a lot of the old hardware is the GameCube. So current developers that are coming in to developing can use the code that they've, or old developers can use the code that they've already developed for the GameCube for use on the Wii, instead of throwing everything away like people have to do with the PS3 and creating a completely new development budget, which increases the price even more.
Well,
by doing that, the developers are able to take risks on extremely innovative games that are not necessarily guaranteed sellers like Elebits or other quirky games that the Wii already has.
Barini Kaplan, do you agree with that?
I 100% agree. I always tell people that the Wii is a very, very powerful system. You know, we're not launching rocket ships. We're just playing video games, and that's all you really need. And it allows developers to have an entry point that is not so expensive. You know, we get really creative people out of garages who could even enter to do this if they wanted to, and the top developers.
Chris, thanks. I'm afraid we got to go, Chris, but thanks for the call. I appreciate
it.
And Perrin Kaplan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Perrin Kaplan is Vice President of Nintendo America and joined us from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. More on Who's Gaming Now when we come back from a short break. This is the Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Sales of video games topped $7 billion last year, and that doesn't include the billions more spent on things like consoles, joysticks, and other gaming gadgets. A lot of money, yes, but the industry is at a crossroads. Today we're talking about where games go from here and who is actually gaming. Our guest is Lev Grossman, who writes about the tech industry for Time Magazine, and we want to hear from gamers. Do you want better technology or more interesting and more compelling storylines? If you work in the industry, where do you see the business heading? If you're not a gamer, what would get you involved? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. And here's an email we got from Thomas Kennedy. My husband and I want to play games, but it's a mystery to us on how to get started. The industry has done a terrible job of marketing to older people 50+. And I guess, Lev Grossman, they weren't thinking about marketing to people 50+.
That's true. There's a tendency, I think, within the industry to forget about people who are older than the age of, say, 30. And I think, not to sort of harp on Nintendo, but they did something very interesting last year, which is they released a game called BrainAge. BrainAge was a game specifically targeted at people, at retired people, at people over the age of 60, senior citizens. Who had ever even thought of trying to sell these people games? But it turns out they have time and they have money and they are curious enough to give things a whirl. Now, Brain Age, Nintendo's senior citizen game, has sold millions of copies. That's basically free money. It was a market sector that didn't exist before.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Shannon. Shannon with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to comment. I'm a female gamer. I've been playing video games probably since my dad used to own a video game company when we were smaller, the actual stand-up ones.
Uh-huh.
And I'm currently a Pal M League player in for Counter-Strike, which is based off of the Half-Life 2 source, and never got into console gaming because it simply is not good enough for me. I've always done computer gaming. The graphics controls just haven't been there yet, and I'm kind of curious why people haven't gone more the route of trying to get better ways for us to use the games. I mean, I can't even use a regular controller. I have to have my mouse or my keyboard or I'm lost.
Lev?
I mean, this is one of the things we're talking about. I think you would probably self-identify as a hardcore gamer.
Yes.
The industry, you know, on some level, doesn't sort of care about you anymore. They have you, and what they're desperate to do is find people who would be scared to get into a Counter-Strike game. Have no idea what Half-Life is. I actually think, I used to be a mouse and keyboard gamer myself. I actually gave up on it because I just couldn't keep upgrading my PC fast enough to keep it playing. You know, the new games were coming out. I ended up becoming a console gamer just because the hardware had a life cycle of 4 or 5 years.
Interesting. Shannon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Of course, when we talk about bringing in new gamers, it will depend largely on the quality of the games that are available. Raf Koster is a former creative designer for Sony Online Entertainment and author of the book A Theory of Fun for Game Design. He joins us now from the studio at member station KPBS in San Diego. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you. And it's not raining down here in Southern California.
Can't imagine why it's different from Northern California. Anyway, is there a creative crisis in the gaming industry at the moment?
Actually, what I think we're seeing is the industry splitting into different segments. There is a crisis in what I'd call the hardcore, core gamer, retail publisher side of the industry, where, as Lev noted, costs have risen dramatically. The size of the games has gotten extraordinary. The games are incredibly complex, and they're not reaching new audiences. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we are seeing a real boom in entirely new arenas, such as games launch directly onto the web, what's called digital distribution. New kinds of publishers that bypass the box stores that, grandmothers are not going to walk into the traditional retail game store to look for something. But they're very likely, in fact, to play a casual game on the web, a puzzle game like Bejeweled.
Mm-hmm. Is that right, do you think, Lev Grossman? Do you think that there's that split that Raf is talking about?
That sounds correct to me. One of the phenomena I've seen in the last couple of months is a game called Line Rider, which it's an online game, exists in a web page, and all it is a little dude on a sled going down a hill, mm-hmm. and you can design the hill by making it sort of curly or straight or making faces out of it. I assume it exists in Java, it costs nothing to play, and it's massively popular. And it's true, that is a huge new market. I'm curious as to whether, one, that's something that can be monetized by the industry, whether there's money in it or it's just a hobby thing for the creators, and two, you know, whether it's going to push the medium forward artistically in the way that I think a lot of gamers would love to see it go forward.
Raf, do you think so?
I think we're already seeing it. Certainly, there is big money in casual games. The portals, as they call them, such as MSN Games, Miniclip, Club Penguin, and so on, are attracting a really broad demographic. The typical casual game player is actually a housewife in her 30s, rather than being kind of the 18-year-old male that we come to expect.
Depends on how you're defining game, though, doesn't it?
Well, here's the thing. Everybody is a gamer, right? We all grow up playing games. Games are kind of a fundamental way in which we learn things as children. Even animals play games in order to learn. You know, everybody's seen a cat hunt a toy mouse. So it's really a question of whether the games that are appropriate for a given person are available. And I think what we're seeing in the industry today is an explosion of games that actually target different kinds of people and therefore different kinds of play.
So there could be Sudoku games for people, and they're games, but they're not the kind of games that the gaming industry considers games.
That's right. They don't have high-res graphics, and they certainly don't have a large gun front and center.
Okay, well, if we could work out that Sudoku thing, I think a lot of people would point the gun at themselves a lot of the time. But anyway, let's see if we can get Paul on the line. Paul's calling us from Long Island.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things very quickly in the interest of full disclosure. I have two sons. My wife has bought them nearly every game system out there. I've played a number of them, so I am familiar with them. And I also want to say I respect every single comment that's been said so far in favor of this. I'm not a big gamer. I'm maybe one of the reasons that the market's grown a bit stagnant. For me, I tie it into two things. I look at childhood obesity rates. I look at sedentary, like prolonged sedentary activities, and I tend to link that to gaming. I see, you know, anytime I've gone over to a friend's house, I see their kids, you know, with a fistful of Doritos and their thumbs going wild with the controllers. For me, also, in terms of time management, I'm a Broadway musician, and I just started a political consulting business. So if I think I have, if I have 3 or 4 hours to kill, at the end of the day, I'd like to say I memorized a piece of music. I wrote a position paper for my business. I maybe built a piece of cabinetry. I can't imagine at the end of the day saying, you know what, I blasted away God knows how many creatures or aliens or enemies or something like that.
You saved the galaxy.
So anyway, just food for thought. And I'll take any responses off the air.
Paul, thanks for the question. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks.
Raf, are you looking into something that could scratch that potential itch that he's talking about?
It, you know, it's definitely an area that I think is of growing concern to the industry. Games right now, you do have to ask the question, are they providing something valuable to society, right? If they are just frivolous, hyper-realistic, gory games of cops and robbers, then, you know, maybe not. But games fundamentally are really teaching tools. A game, when you look at it in an abstract way, is teaching you basically mathematical models of reality. They're teaching you how to do things like money management in the case of something like Monopoly. They're teaching you how to assess trajectories of high-velocity objects. You know, things like that. So they are actually instructive in some way. The question is what lessons they teach. And we're seeing a burgeoning movement called serious games, which is the application of really core game design towards more valuable uses, such as, for example, a therapeutic game. I believe it's called Ben's Game, which was developed as part of the Make-A-Wish Foundation to help kids who are suffering from cancer learn about their bodies and, you know, blast away at cancer cells within mm-hmm. themselves. There are many, many applications of this. It's actually being used, for example, for international diplomacy. There's a project, I believe it's called Peacemaker, which is about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's a game you play. Or Ayiti, The High Cost of Life, in which you attempt to manage a Haitian family, their finances, to get them to survive through a few years.
Well, there are games that seem to be similar, at least, to some of the ones you're talking about. Sims, for example. I mean, that's a teaching game. I assume we're going to have a new generation of city planners somewhere.
That's right. And SimCity was one of the first games to really reveal the potential for that sort of thing. But it's really a burgeoning field now. These conferences are being attended by nonprofits and by, the drug companies are showing up. Everybody, the government is very interested. One of the best known is actually America's Army, which is actually used as a recruiting tool by the United States military.
Here's an email we got from Davey in Baker City, Oregon. I've been slowing down on gaming. I have a console. I play from time to time. However, I found few games as of late that quench my more literary appetites, perhaps games that more closely resemble the story thread of novels, say, for instance, a genre like mystery or detective. I feel this could have great appeal to my age group, 23 to 30, and college-level education. And Lev Grossman, are people looking into that as a boutique or niche area for games?
I actually think that they are in a ways that, you know, games don't always get credit for. Games are, along with whatever else they are, they're a storytelling medium. They're a narrative medium in which characters appear and they solve problems and they grow and they change. There's no reason why, you know, we couldn't get to a level where you see the kind of psychological or literary complexity that you see in novels. I think one game that doesn't get credit for that, and it should, is the notorious Grand Theft Auto, which is a very complicated branching system of narratives which you as the player negotiate. Now, you know, there's also some killing going on, don't get me wrong.
I thought there was an instruction course at the beginning, how to hotwire.
that too. But at the same time, I mean, this is, you know, there's no question that they are on the edge of a kind of avant-garde kind of multifaceted storytelling technique that is interesting.
Is that why we're seeing more and more? There's a Godfather game now. There's a Scarface game. These are characters with whom we are familiar. We expect them to act in certain ways and change, I guess, in certain ways.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's the potential. I don't think it's been realized yet. There's the potential for games absolutely to deliver on that kind of psychological nuance and complexity. One of my favorite games of the past few years was called Max Payne. I think it did that very well. I think, on the other hand, the Godfather game is quite lame, so we're all still learning.
Well, maybe you should go over and meet somebody's little friend. Who knows? we're talking with Lev Grossman of Time Magazine and with Raf Koster, a former creative officer for Sony Online Entertainment and author of A Theory of Fun for Game Design, about the future of gaming. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on. This is Stanley. Stanley with us from Odessa, Texas.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Okay.
I'm 51 years old, and I've been playing the massive multiplayer online games for about 8 years.
And those are the computer games where you go on and take on the character of an avatar. Which game do you play, Stanley?
Right now, I'm currently playing World of Warcraft.
World of Warcraft, and there are, as I understand, millions who play along with you.
Oh, yes.
And do you get into it mostly for the, I gather, as Lev Grossman has said earlier, the opportunity every once in a while to stick your battle axe in the back of someone's neck or to hang out with your friends?
Exactly that. I've got people I've known for the last 8 years that I've met online, and I've never met them in real person, but we've seen their kids growing up, broken arms, go to the hospital, get better, birthdays, everything.
Mm.
My granddaughter was born, and I helped her online, and everybody was cheering in this one city when I told them what I was holding at one time. To me, it's a great hobby.
Stanley, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Raf Koster, one of the things we tend to forget, these games are played very much one-on-one. There's one person sitting there, but certainly the World of Warcraft games and increasingly console games too, you're playing an environment with other people.
Yeah, I actually think it's a mistake to think as gamers, as solitary people, kind of bathing in the glow of the tube. In practice, the default mode for playing even single-player console games is with a bunch of people taking turns on a couch. Gaming has always been a social activity, the thrall of human history, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing now is the network is really enabling these kind of multiplayer experiences and almost beyond multiplayer. Massively multiplayer games, which is the sort of game that I make, actually, the kind of game that the caller plays, are really simulations of entire worlds where thousands of people play together. And they don't have to just play slashing orcs. Common activities today in massively multiplayer games include, obviously, combat and dragon slaying, but also saving villages, building villages, running shops, crafting goods, entire economies, dance troupes, bands, weddings, you name it, somebody's doing it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've all heard the criticism of, gee, it'd be wonderful to have all those bands and that village building right here in the real world.
Well, you know, a lot of the people who manage to do bands, for example, in the virtual world are people who maybe don't know how to play an instrument in the real world, which actually has a much higher barrier of entry, so to speak. We've also seen a lot of times skills from the virtual worlds translate out. So, for example, somebody who becomes the mayor of a virtual town, it's not unusual for them to learn organizational skills, which they then turn around and apply to, for example, real-world businesses. And I've known many people who were, for example, shy or disabled in some way, who got over it, essentially, and were able to go into the real world and really make a difference.
Here's an email we got from Patty. I'm a 30-year-old woman and was never into video games until I met my husband. Now I play all the time online. I love it. This weekend we bought our Wii, and since we've gotten it, my 3-year-old daughter to play is now playing the bowling game with my 63-year-old father, two people who never played a video game before. They had a great time. In fact, our daughters have been trying out all of the sports games since, and we're having lots of fun. So, Lev Grossman, this suggests that there might be a little crossover appeal, though you hear this sort of anecdotal thing, I think, about every new device that comes out.
Well, that's true. But, you know, a few years ago, sociologist Robert Putnam wrote a book called Bowling Alone about the demise of community in America. And the big sort of anecdotal lead for that was the decline of the bowling league. And I think, you know, there's cause for hope in video games. And I think it builds all kinds of social bonds that are in no way invalid or perverse. I think it would be a huge mistake not to value them because they are very real and very human and very good.
We're going to ask both Lev Grossman and Raf Koster to stay with us. We'll take a couple more of your calls on this point. When we come back from a short break, we're talking about changes in technology and changes in thinking about video games. Again, our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. Right now, let's finish our conversation about new gamers. Lev Grossman is still with us. He writes about the tech industry for Time magazine. His latest novel is called Codex. Also with us is Raf Koster, former creative officer for Sony Online Entertainment, author of the book A Theory of Fun for Game Design. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Gary. Gary's with us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Real quick. I've done occasional gaming. I've done Project Gotham, City of Heroes. My sister, she does like SimCity, and occasional, Doom. But the one thing that did get my attention too about games being instructional, teaching abstracts, I think it also does some kind of subliminal things to you as well. And my main concern of that is stereotyping. I mean, we talked about Godfather and Scarface, and I have seen some games that on the cover on itself, I just put back NBA Street Jams or Grand Theft Auto because, again, reinforcing racial stereotypes. And I think they need more writers or more people of color to get involved in the process to get a different perspective. And I was wondering what your thought is on that.
Lev Grossman, what do you think?
I haven't seen too many examples that I would really call egregious, although I do think that it's interesting that the Grand Theft Auto games, which deal with a lot of American minorities, are produced, I believe, out of Scotland. Certainly, any medium when it's young, people have to learn some hard lessons. If you look at the early comic strips, for example, they're kind of toe-curling in their use of racial stereotypes. So I think, like any young medium, games probably have some lessons to learn, but I give them a pretty passing grade.
Is Gary right, though, that the power structure at the companies that develop these games, is that largely white?
I think Raf could probably address that better than I could.
Raf?
There's definitely a lack of diversity overall in the video game industry. Relatively few female programmers, although there are more and more each year. When you do run into women, for example, they tend to be in the marketing department, not among the developers. Relatively few African Americans, although there are a fair amount of Asians. So this is something that's changing over time as more people come into the industry. 10 years ago, if you asked a kid maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, what do you want to be when you grow up? They'd probably tell you an athlete or maybe a rock star. Today, game developer is on that list. And as this reaches out into the youth, I think what we're going to see is greater diversity wanting to actually work on making games.
Gary,
and that should help the problem.
Gary, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to this is Kevin. Kevin with us from Phoenix.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I wanted to comment that I have played multiplayer online games for quite a while, and I realized when I started playing Second Life and Rhizome that the big change seems to be away from hunting and gathering, that people want to interact with their world personally. I want to create, not I just want to interact with somebody else has made.
Mm-hmm.
And in that vein, you can create, then you can sell, and directly you wouldn't have to keep a real-life job anymore. So going back to what the gentleman said about I don't see people, going out anymore, I build cabinetry. Well, I think you're looking at a whole new generation that's going to move totally to an online environment for everything they enjoy.
I should just explain Second Life, which was one of the games that Kevin referenced. It's something we've talked about on this program, but it's one of these virtual worlds where there are many, many thousands of people there at any one time, all doing different things or gathering together to talk to each other as friends. But Raf Koster, that seemed to be one of the things that you were talking about, what Kevin is talking about, that these virtual worlds can become something entirely new.
That's right. They really can simulate pretty much any aspect of the real world. And what we're seeing now, specifically with Second Life and other titles like it, is instead of merely simulating the real world, they actually embrace the actual real world in many ways. So, for example, you can create virtual replicas of items and sell them for real money to other players. And this so-called microtransaction market worldwide is rapidly increasing into the tens of millions of dollars.
Kevin, thanks very much. Enjoy your time online.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's wind up by asking you both about the future of this industry, and you referred to it earlier, Lev. More and more people can get games online by independent creators, even by cell phone. This industry is what happened before to the music industry, what happening, I guess, to some degree, to the book industry, what's happening to the broadcast industry. Is that now happening to gaming?
Well, I certainly think gaming is only going to get sort of richer and more complicated and more rewarding as the lines between sort of solo gaming and offline communities and sort of forums for social interaction, as they grow together, as a service like Xbox Live gets larger and more robust. You know, I think gaming will become part of our social life in a really interesting, positive way, I hope.
And Raf, I wanted to get your thoughts on that same point.
I think that we are heading for an inflection point. I think in many ways, just as it is in television and in film, the days of the blockbuster are fading a little bit. They're no longer sustainable in terms of cost for the audience that they get. And I think what we're really seeing now is kind of the thousands of individual creators making lower-end games rather than the incredibly expensive ones, and really in the process bringing in new audiences, new ideas, new kinds of gameplay, and hopefully just broadening it out so much that everybody can get back to being a gamer the way they were when they were kids.
Raf Koster, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Raf Koster, former creative officer, for Sony Online Entertainment. His book is A Theory of Fun for Game Design. He was with us today from the studios of KPBS, our member station in San Diego. Lev Grossman, thank you for your time today, too.
Thank you very much.
Lev Grossman writes about technology for Time magazine. His latest novel is called Codex, and he was at our NPR bureau in New York.